Let's go back in time to 1932 as Converse brings you historic footage of the legendary original Celtics with whom all great professional teams are compared.
We have now taken over your radio.
Richie Guerin is about to show you the most important step in getting past a man. It's the first one.
And Oscar will inbound it. The men in green, the Milwaukee Bucks, that's Al Cinder against Bellamy.
Has Jordan. Allen shakes free. Gets two!
Gilmore on
a big stop! Oh,
brother! Lead Toledo Artis. You get 21.
4:28 to go in the first quarter for the Cal Palace. Here's Barry.
Jordan. Open. Chicago with the lead!
Hello, and welcome back to the Over and Back Classic NBA podcast at HarvardProfessor.com. I am Jason Mann, and with me as usual is Rich Krenich. Rich, great to be back with you.
Yeah, so good to jump back into the WrestleMania series. Unfortunately, I've been out for a while, but I'm excited to get back to talking on Bill Russell here. So we got some fun stuff coming up as well. This is going to be a cool little micro-series within the series that we're going to be doing in the next few weeks. So excited to see how it goes.
We've already done some of the finals battles that Russell and the Celtics had with the Hawks, with Adam Cribbley and the Lakers with Bijan Bain. Some great shows there. So we're gonna kind of dig into some of the other notable playoff battles that the Celtics had over the years, which I think we'll glean some interesting insights from there and talk about a few of the key players from the other teams and just kind of get a sense of the league and of Russell's accomplishments and so on and so forth. So this should be fun. So the Nationals and Celtics played three times in the playoffs, 57, 59, and 61. The Celtics won all of those series. We'll go into specifics in a moment, but first I want to talk about Dolph Schayes, and he passed away fairly recently, December 10th, 2015, of cancer at age 87. Really one of the early great players of NBA history. Six-time All-NBA first team, six times on the second team. Played 15 years and never missed a game for nine seasons. Best known for his rebounding and his two-handed set shots, is his shot arc so high that his teammates called it Sputnik. And, you know, he was sort of a guy, all the obituaries that I read about him sort of kind of consider him a bridge from the old game to the new game, because he definitely had his foot sort of in both sides, and he played from 49 through 63, 64. So that certainly, you know, that obviously the game
covers a transcendent that time. Absolutely, yeah, it's like a transcendent era there of difference of what he came into and what he left. It's incredible to think of that transformation.
Yeah, so he and he was equally good with his right hand and his left. He shot running one-handers. In fact, he developed the left hand after he broke his right hand to spend most of the season with his right hand in a cast. So, and he was a forward, but he had an outside shot that was about as accurate as guards. Excellent free throw shooter as well. He was the first NBA player to score 15,000 points. When he retired, he had played in the most games in NBA history and had the second most points, only behind Bob Pettit. Also, the third most rebounds and the second best free throw percentage. He was a son of Jewish immigrants from Romania, born in the Bronx. He started NYU and helped them reach the NCAA final at the age of 16. And, you know, basketball was very popular in Jewish communities of many cities, with barnstorming teams. There were Jewish barnstorming teams in the early days of pro basketball before really the pro leagues were organized. And the early NBA actually had a very Jewish a large Jewish population. There was a pretty big community of of Jewish players, and it was, you know, being that a lot of the cities had a large Jewish population, so it definitely had an appeal there. And he, in 1977, he coached the United States game to the gold medal in the the Maccabi Games, the Jewish Olympics in Israel, so which was a kind of a big upset there. So he also is known for probably being the best Jewish player in NBA history.
Absolutely. And just a quick thing, his son, Danny Shays, actually had a very kind of surprising. I know I'd heard the name and I know he had been in the league for a while, but I was actually kind of surprised at how productive he was. I mean, he was in the league for 18 seasons and his best year coming, I'd say definitely his best year coming on the 87-88 Denver Nuggets, which is definitely the best Denver Nuggets team of the Doug Moe crazy, let's score as many points as humanly possible Denver Nuggets team. And he averaged 13.9 points per game, 8.2 rebounds per game, and had 8.8 win shares that year. And that's just a crazy team as well. I mean, they ended up, I think they made it to the Western Conference semifinals, if I remember correctly. And they lost to the Mavericks. Yeah, so they did make it to the semifinals, lost to the Mavericks. 154 that year, but actually a really good team. You know, Alex English, of course, at the top of his powers, Fat Lever, Jay Vincent, Michael Adams, and then Danny Shays right there. And he's a guy who, again, like I said, 18 seasons in the league and hung around a lot longer than maybe I remember, or most people do remember. He's not just, his father's son. He actually kind of carved out his own little pretty decent career in the NBA as well. So, yeah, kind of fun little facts on his son.
Yeah, yeah. So the Nationals became the 76ers in 1964. They moved from Syracuse to Philadelphia after a couple years after the Warriors had left Philadelphia. So. And in fact, his number four jersey was retired by the 76ers. A little bit late on that, but a nice honor nonetheless. So the Celtics had a pretty stout rivalry with the Nationals pre Bill Russell. Of course, when you only have eight teams in your league and six of them make the playoffs, it's easy to get some playoff rivalries. But the Nationals had won the 1955 NBA title and had made the 54 and 50 finals, all with Dolph Shays as the top player. And they made the division finals or finals in 9 out of 12 years. So they were, advancing pretty far in the playoffs, even if it was, just a round or two during those times. And they faced off 4 years in a row prior to the 57 when Russell joins the team. 53, the Celtics actually won 2-0. 54, the Nationals won 3-1, made the finals that year. In 55, the Nationals won again 3-1. And in 56, they won 2-1. So so the first series in 57, the Celtics won in a 3-0 sweep in the Eastern Division Finals. The Nationals were 38-34. The Celtics were a high 50s win team. I don't have the exact number here, but they were a significantly better team and won the division at that time. The Nationals had beaten the 56 champion Warriors 2-0 in the semis. It was the first time the defending champs had been swept, and it also avenged a Warriors win over the Nationals in 56. And the Celtics were led by Bob Cousy, who was the 57 MVP. They also had Bill Sharman. They had some veterans, Andy Phillip and Arnie Risen, who had come over from other teams. They also had Jack Nichols, who was a veteran who had played on Auerbach's teams in Washington and in Tri-Cities before he came to the Celtics and retired after 58. Jack Nichols, during his last 3 years with the Celtics, he attended dental school full-time and earned his Doctor of Dentistry in 1958. Which is, of course, you don't see a lot of players today attending dental
school. Who would be the one player in the league that you think would attend dental school?
Andre Miller?
I don't know if he counts. Does he count? Does Andre Miller count? Okay, I guess. Player under the age of 50.
All right.
Because he looks like a dentist. You can't count the guy. He might be a dentist. For all I know, he might just have that in his back pocket. He's just waiting for that.
We'll look that up later. I'm sticking with Professor, so...
All right, that's a cop-out, right. But that's fine. It's such a good answer. That's the problem. That's why I'm very upset by it, but...
And they also had Frank Ramsey and Jim Loskutoff, who were both... weren't rookies, but were young players on the team. And this was Bill Russell's rookie year. Tom Heinsohn was a rookie as well, who had actually won the Rookie of the Year that year. Russell had coming in about a third of the way into the season, so... the Nationals, on the other hand, were their key players were Shays, of course. Red Kerr, who had come in the title season and had made a big difference there. He was a center. Later, of course, important in Chicago Bulls folklore. Earl Lloyd, who was one of the first African-American players in the NBA, Paul Seymour was a player coach who had just taken over from longtime coach and former player Al Servi, and Ed Conlin, who was in his second year. The newcomers were Al Bianchi, Joe Holup, Bob Hopkins, Togo Palasi, who was one of my favorite '50s. He had actually come from Boston that season. And probably my favorite new random trivia NBA player. You take this one, Rick.
Yeah, so this guy, I think, is our new favorite. Our team, or at least our podcast's favorite new player, is Forrest Frosty Abel, who has an incredible name, an incredible nickname, and maybe my favorite NBA career of all time. I'm going to read you his line here, his career line. He played 1 minute. One game, he got one rebound, one assist, one personal foul, and two field goal attempts.
Yes.
What a man. Like he got in there and was like, I am making the most of this. Like, I am Frosty Abel, and I do not get in many games. I'm going to make the most. And like, in 1 minute, how do you get a rebound, an assist, a foul, and shoot twice?
What was a fast-paced game?
Like that guy dominated the game. Like, were they forcing him the ball, or like it has to be, right? It's got to be like a Boban, for the Spurs type deal, or like a Brian Scalabrine thing, where it's like
do it for Frosty.
That's a line. That is a hell of a line for 1 minute. But unfortunately for old Frosty Abel, that was his final.
That was it for his
career. Yeah, well,
1 minute to one game. Yeah,
that's not great. But
a couple of guys, I think, who have that. I think Basketball Reference has that listed somewhere. But
the guys only played a minute. Yeah, actually, no. Here, while you're talking about the next guy, I'm going to look up all of our
I'll describe the series.
You do whatever you want to do with this. I'm derailing this entire episode while I talk about Frosty Abel. But you do whatever the Celtics Russell thing that you're doing right now is. So
all right, fair enough. the Celtics won games 1 and 2 easily. Game 3 was an 83-80 Celtics win in Boston. Shays had 22 points, including 12 of 12 from the line. Seymour had 15. Meanwhile, Boston was led by Sharman with 23. Loskadoff, Kuzi, Hines, and Russell all were in double figures. In fact, Russell averaged 15.3 points and 30-plus rebounds during this series. We don't have the exact number of rebounds, but we know it's more than 30. Seymour was forced to sit Red Kerr for long stretches against the Celtics because Russell would always block his hook shot, according to King of the Court. Kerr's quote is, I play 60 games in the hole during the season, meaning in the paint, and 12 outside against Russell, just because, you know, he was unable to, like a lot of people, was unable to get his shot off while being defended against Russell. So Rich, did you find...
I have 8 players all time that have played 1 minute or less. So tell me your favorite memory of each of these guys, please. I'll pause and let you have a moment. Alex Scales on the 2006 San Antonio Spurs. You remember him?
Oh, old Scalies.
Old Alex Scales, yeah. Andy Panko on the 2001 Atlanta Hawks.
Oh, old Pancreas, yeah. I remember him.
Cedric Hunter on the 92 Hornets. Norm Greinke, I think I'm pronouncing that right, on the 54 Philadelphia Warriors.
Old Greinke, absolutely. Yeah,
this guy doesn't even need a nickname. James on Curry from the 2010 Los Angeles Clippers. So he's just James on. Okay. You don't even need to add anything there.
Yeah, old James on.
Yeah, that's Barry Sumpter.
James on, James off.
Yeah, right. Barry Sumpter from the 89 Clippers.
Oh, yeah, old Sumpty.
Yep. Yeah. Dave Scholes from the 70 Philadelphia 76ers. And then old Frosty Abel. Now a good one. Dave Scholes is the only one to score. He had 2 points. I want to. Who had the most field goal attempts of all these players that have played a minute or less?
I would guess. James on Curry.
Believe it or not, he never got a shot off. Your number one field goal attempts is old Frosty Abel with those two. He threw those two in there. Dave Scholes had, he was 1 for 1, so that's a solid career. I hope he took the game ball home. And then Barry Sumpter, who unfortunately missed his one attempt, but that's it. And Forrest is also the only one to record a rebound, the only one to record an assist, not the only one to record a foul, though. Norm Greinke also jumped in and got a foul on that as well. So Frosty Abel is definitely the most efficient one game. Or 1 minute player in NBA history. So
Well, he was 0 for 2 from field.
Time. Well, you know, hey, it's not all about scoring, all right? It's not all about you know, there's other aspects of the game, Jason. All right, so let's let's let Frosty Abel off the hook a little bit. Yeah,
fouling.
And fouling, right? Yeah, it was a good foul. It was a good foul. The guy had a wide open lane to the basket, so you get a good foul. You wrap him up and you know take him to the line. So.
There you go. Good times. That's a nice. I'm glad to have learned that. So, so the 1959 Eastern Division Finals. This was the best series between these two teams. Celtics won it in seven. The records that year, the Celtics were 52-20. Nationals were 35-37. So not necessarily a good regular season team, but there's some context here that. We'll talk about the Nationals had beaten the Knicks 2-0 in the previous round. This was in fact the Knicks' last playoff appearance until 1967, which is pretty impressive considering again there were only 8 or later 9 teams in the league during this time, and 6 of them made the playoffs. So the Knicks to be able to miss the playoffs that many times in a row is that's an accomplishment.
It's almost like the Knicks now. I was gonna say it's almost akin to again half the league going into the playoffs and the Knicks somehow finding a way not to get in there, but. We just got now. People are very mad at me, but that's all right.
Well, it's okay. They're mad at us for they have a lot of reasons to be mad at us, so we'll be all right. So we've got Russell, we've got Cousy, we got Charmin, we got Heinsohn, we got Ramsey, we got Loskadoff, and we got Sam Jones there as well. And Risen, Phillip, and Nichols have all retired. Some new players for the Celtics. We have Gene Conley, who was also a baseball pitcher, pitched for Milwaukee, I believe, and maybe the Yankees as well. He definitely was a experienced pitcher, but also served as Bill Russell's backup for a few years. Casey Jones was rookie who, of course, had played with a good friend of Bill Russell's who had played with him at the University of San Francisco. We've talked about Casey's influence on Russell in other shows. And you made a note here of Gene Conley, not the only MLB-NBA crossover.
No, there's quite a few, actually. And this, in doing research for this and an episode we're going to do later in this series, looking at Dave DeBuscher, I got kind of interested in looking at some of the histories of some of these guys. And there's a few, and I might actually write something up about these guys if I get a chance. But some of the famous ones, people do, of course, most people know the Danny Ainge one. You know, he played for the Toronto Blue Jays. There's also Ron Reed. Dave DeBuscher was one that I completely forgot, and he played for my hometown White Sox as well, and I forgot. And then like Dave DeBuscher has another, we'll talk about it in our other show, you know, he also coached for a little while too. He had a fascinating career before he really reached like the peak that we all sort of know him as. Like he had this little first and second life before we even know that. But of course Gene Conley, as you mentioned, Dave DeBuscher, Ron Reed, Danny Ainge, there's a few other ones as well, and most recently Mark Hendrickson is a crossover MLB and NBA player. But I do not see that happening ever again. That's it's just weird skill sets, like, you know what I mean? Like I could see like, you know, NFL and MLB happening. I mean, it seems so wild that any of them can happen again, but the idea of like an MLB and an NBA player happening again just seems so radical. Like they just seem like such different skill sets that it's amazing that there's even been, you know, 9 or whatever people that have done it.
Right. Has there ever been a NBA NFL crossover?
Oh man.
I mean, I would just imagine those seasons sort of overlap too much, but
that's an interesting one. I don't know. Yeah.
I remember maybe looking it up, but I don't remember the answer. So, well, anybody, if they know, they can
please do. Yes, yeah.
Over and back NBA. So, the Nationals team, a good bit different here. We have Shays, Redker, Conlin, Bianchi, Hopkins, Pelosi still there. Larry Costello, who came over in 58 from the Warriors, would later be an important part of the some 76ers teams and then would be the coach of the Bucks during the Kareem years. And Seymour, who was at the very end of his career. New players were Hal Greer, who was a rookie, would later be a top 50 player, another important part of the 76ers rivalry with Russell. Connie Dierking, who would be a part of the a 76ers Warriors trade that would land the 76ers Will Chamberlain, and then George Yardley, who was a really stout scorer of the in the 1950s, was traded from Detroit in the middle of the season. He'd actually led the NBA in points the previous year, 58. but was near the end of his career. He was could still play, but he basically just hated the NBA life and was ready to get out of it. And, of course, the money was not what it is today. And also the Pistons were a notoriously anti-union, anti-worker organization. Their owner was a notoriously anti-union, so I'm guessing the pay was not particularly stout for the Pistons during that time. So Shane's actually called this team the best that they ever had in Syracuse. I'm assuming once Yardley came on board, because basically that gave them a second score. And if you look at the box scores of these games, Yardley's definitely providing a big scoring punch during this time. In fact, game two, which was one of the first one of the close games of the series, Boston wins 128-120. Shea's at 34, Yardley at 27, Kuzi at 27, and then Hines and Charmin, Russell and Ramsey all scored 19 or 20 in the game. Boston did have three wins of 21 points or more in this series, which honestly, it's an interesting thing about Boston. I feel like in the late 50s and early 60s is that in a lot of these series, they would lose all the close games and then would win more of the blowouts.
Yeah, yeah. I noticed that in doing a lot of research as well. It's a very unique thing.
Yeah, it happened a lot with the Hawks, and that kind of shows that Boston was generally the regular season team, but it's weird that they had such problems losing those close games, given that they of course have this reputation, well deserved given what they did in game sevens of being the clutch team. But at least in the early days, it was more that they would win by blowouts and then they would lose the close games. So
it did seem going through of course looking at a bunch of these series, it seemed like there was games that whenever they played their pace, the very quick pace, it would be a blowout. But anytime it was sort of a slowdown game, it seemed like it was always close. So it's interesting to see, and I noticed a lot of really close games, and a lot of the ones that they dropped were games that were so very not super low scoring, but maybe in the 80s and the 90s, and the ones that they won were the 120, or the ones that they really blew out were 120. They'd win by 20 points or whatever doing that. So it's an interesting thought, but yeah, I think maybe a little bit deeper dive would be fun looking into that and looking at the anatomy of the games that they lost, the close games they lost compared to the ones that they had big blowouts in.
Yeah, absolutely. So Shea's averaged 28.4 points in the series, Yardley 25.7. Ramsey, meanwhile, was leading scorer for the Celtics, which is interesting because he was, the sixth man coming off the bench, but he was still able to lead the team in scoring in certain situations. Kuzi at 21.0, Russell 19.1. And according to King of the Court, Kuzi and Shea's both dealt with stomach viruses. Ramsey sprained his finger, Shea sprained his ankle, and Yardley had a cast on his non-shooting hand during the series. So a lot of guys are banged up. Of course, it was during this time, guys didn't miss games that much, because it was just harder to they didn't have the same benefits they do today. If they they don't play enough, they lose their job, and it's a bad situation. So they were gutting out more injuries than they certainly should have been, and that should kind of in shortened careers and a lot of other problems they had. But the best game of the series was a pretty classic game seven. The Celtics win 130-125. The Nationals have a 16-point lead in the second quarter. And kind of a funny story by Celtics broadcaster Johnny Most during this game.
Yeah, it's a common issue that happens with a lot of us when we get really excited watching basketball. But yeah, Celtics broadcaster Johnny Most, he got so excited he nearly lost his dentures over the rail of the upper press box, which is a current thing that happens with all... Mike Tirico, I know, complains about it all the time, is when he gets in the moment. And Hubie Brown might come. I don't know. It might be an issue for Hubie Brown, but not many other broadcasters have dentures anymore. So yeah, he nearly lost his dentures over over the rail of the upper press deck, which would have been an interesting find for anybody below him that had a pair of dentures land in their lap and no clue what to do with that. I don't know how you react to that, but yeah, very, very interesting, and just kind of a microcosm of old school announcers. We're nice, sweet old dudes. Now they're all, these young whippersnappers. And
yeah. Which is funny because Johnny Most was still the announcer in the 80s. So how old would he have been and still had dentures in?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, you're right.
59. Of course, dental health was.
Yeah,
we won't dwell on that.
No, let's dwell. No, I'm just joking. Let's see how old was Johnny.
How old Johnny Most was at that point?
Yeah, I'm just kind of curious. Well, he died in 93. 23. He was born in 23. He was born in 1923. So yeah, he wasn't that old. Jeez.
Yeah, he was. Yeah, he was 40-ish.
So yeah, floss.
Yeah. Brush your teeth, kids. Yeah, that's all I have to say.
Exactly. So. What a PSA from Jason and Rich.
Yes. So his story said, he also said that he said in the second half it was the most perfectly played basketball game I've ever seen. Heinsohn often said it was the best game he ever played in. So. After being down by 16 in the second quarter, the Celtics charged back in the third, then Syracuse surged again, but Boston held them off. In the final minute with Boston up three, Cousy flipped up a one-hander to beat the shot clock after having sort of dribbled time off the clock, and fans carried Cousy on their shoulders. Russell, despite fouling out in the closing minutes, had 18 points, 32 rebounds. Shays had 35. Yardley had 32, Ramsey had 28, and Cousy had 25 with 10 assists. So, good performance by the Nationals, but the Celtics just were a little bit better. So,
yeah.
So now we go to 1961 Eastern Division Finals again. Celtics win 4-1 against the Nationals. This year, the Nationals are 38-41. Celtics are 57-22. The Nationals had swept a 46-win Warriors team 3-0. This was actually Wilt's second season, so that was kind of a bit of a surprise for the Warriors to lose that series with Wilt there. The key Celtics were Russell, of course, Cousy, Heinsohn, Sam Jones, Ramsey, Casey Jones, and Bill Sharman, who was in his last season. Gene Conley and Los Katoff are still there. The key new player is Satch Sanders, who was a NYU grab, a power forward who was a great rebounder and stuck with the Celtics through the early 70s. I believe he got 8 rings as well, 7 or 8. Certainly he's up there. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of Celtics are up there, of course, in those ring totals. Nationals, meanwhile, they've overhauled a bit here. They have Shays, and this is actually the first time he did not lead the team in win shares after 11 seasons. So he's starting to slow down. He's in his mid-30s. Hal Greer has picked it up. Red Kerr, Larry Costello, Bianchi's still there. And they have a new coach, Alex Hannum, who would later move on to the Warriors in San Francisco and then return to the franchise return to the 76ers with Wilt again. So he coached Wilt twice, once with the Warriors and once with the 76ers. He also had previously coached the Hawks. He would coach, I think he coached in the ABA as well, so he certainly bounced around the league. This was also the second year in the NBA for Dick Barnett, who would then jump to the ABL and then later play with the Lakers for a few years in the 60s and then most famously play with the Knicks dynasty of the early 70s. They also had Dave Gambi, who would stick around for the 60s and play with a lot of those 76ers teams. Barney Cable and the tallest player in NBA history, 7'3", Sweet Halbrook. What do we know about Sweet?
We know he disappeared a lot. He's a very interesting fellow. So, of course, he was the tallest, as you mentioned, tallest player in history at that point. He was a star at Oregon State, but he only played 2 seasons in the NBA, played some semi-pro basketball before that. Alex Hannum said that he gave Wilt a lot of trouble. I think Wilt even said, I had a quote or two about it as well. Evidence doesn't really quite bear that out, that he had that much issue with it, but it was sort of a tale or a narrative that he gave him trouble, mostly because of his size, being 7'3". Yeah. But then the funnest fact about old Swede is that he would disappear for days at a time. And here's a quote from Alex Hannum. He could have had a worthwhile career if he had taken care of himself. During his second season, he disappeared for a week and we sent the police to look for him. But they couldn't find a 7-footer. He came back on his own, but he would never tell me where he had been. So Alex Hannum wondering how you could lose a 7-foot man. He just would disappear and not come back. And then in later life, he worked as a circus clown and was given the title of the world's tallest clown. So, Sweet Halbrook. That's all I know about Sweet Halbrook.
He and there's a famous photo of him and Russell when they're in college against each other, like standing like side by side and sort of like the reach. And Halbrook is obviously taller, but Russell had such a great reach that the reach is actually fairly equal. Which is interesting there. I think that's talked about in King of the Court as well. So, and not surprisingly, Russell's team won that game, given that they won 55 games in a row. So I think an interesting thing about that, and we'll kind of get into this when we talk about the Celtics 76ers rival, is that Bianchi, Costello, Greer, Kerr, Gamby, and so those five players and Shays as coach would all be part of the 76ers rivalry with the Celtics just a few years later. Mm-hmm. So, and in fact, it's sort of interesting because when the Nationals moved to Philadelphia, they initially had trouble gaining acceptance with the fans because the fans had just been booing the Nationals, you know, against the Warriors just a few years before. So now all these players who had played for the Nationals are suddenly representing the home team, and you know the fans aren't really into it. It wasn't really until Wilt got, you know, came back to Philadelphia, and that, you know, the fans kind of started to come. But
yeah, it's a unique situation. Like, imagine like that happening now, like a team that, you know, like a big rivalry, and then like that team that you hated, you know, replaces your team, and it's kind of like, oh,
right, yeah,
like,
that would, yeah,
hi,
that would just be, like, right, yeah, it's like, oh yeah, all these guys, yeah, that would be weird. I can't think of any situation where that's, you know, anywhere kind of near like that. So anyway, the there's a fun story from game one. It's from King of the Court. The ref's whistle blew as Russell was getting a rebound, and he gave an incredulous double take. A dog had wandered onto the court and stopped under his legs. So, dog on the court.
Yep, a common occurrence in today's NBA as well. It's like, oh, come on. who brought their dog to the arena in the first place? So, like, that's how do you get a dog in there? Do you just kind of like?
Yeah, I don't know how you sneak a dog in there. Maybe there's, you know, there were rats in the arenas famously, so maybe, you know,
they got
they're not really catching the rats, so I don't really know what's going on.
Now you can catch some dogs can catch rats. I don't know, not well. I mean, they more or less just kind of tell you where a rat is, but that's fine. Cats make more sense. I would assume more cats come on it because cats are everywhere. I mean, like baseball, there's always cats running on the damn field, but you know, dogs, that's an interesting case. Unless it was a bark at the arena promotion that they were running during the NBA Finals. I don't know.
I'm sure the Eastern Division Finals. Well, you know, honestly,
they needed attendance. They probably could have used the extra little boost in attendance. So.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, with you know, some of the stuff that happened in the early NBA, that wouldn't attend.
Like the ABA, I'm positive. Like there's probably not a report, but there were at least like seven dogs running on the court during ABA games. But I don't have any facts on that. But makes sense that would happen.
Two of them referees.
Dog. I love the ABA. Someone has to have video. Like, there's got to be some vault of like NBA or like ABA VHSs somewhere, right? Like, somebody had to record them. Please, come on. I mean, we got nothing. We have nothing.
They didn't really have VHS then, so
Betamax,
like widespread. No. So there you go.
Damn it.
Anyway,
did they have VHS? Oh, okay. Not good VHS. Go on. Continue. Sorry.
No. Every game in this series was a blowout. The Nats won Game 2, 115-98. And in game four in Syracuse, there's sort of a famous incident of three fans storming the court, fighting with Auerbach and some of the Celtics. And then later, the fans tried to sue, and there's an infamous pic of Auerbach getting a subpoena while in his underwear that ran actually in the newspapers. so, which is pretty a shady thing for a newspaper to do. And that story's from King of the Court. It's other places as well, but it's a pretty interesting one. You know, just kind of shows the rowdiness of the NBA at the time. And Syracuse was a particularly notorious place for people to play. I mean, that was you know, the small towns would really get into the NBA. I mean, Fort Wayne was a hard place to play. I mean, you know, Rochester. You know, all those venues. I mean, it kind of makes sense because you know, you're going to have a very intimate arenas where those teams are playing, and you're going to have a lot of, different environment, and you're going to have a lot of noise and a lot of, you know, people being on top of you, and just going to add to the craziness of what's going on.
Absolutely, yeah. And I guess
people didn't know how to behave either. So
No, these damn ruffians. But no, yeah,
they're throwing batteries on the court, you know, and even stuff like that. I mean, they're throwing like tomatoes and onions at players, and I mean, just so much craziness going on during this time. In you know, we've talked about just random like weird crowd stuff with, you know, even going into the 80s. You know, talked about it with the 88 finals with the, you know, the Lakers fans running onto the court. You know, when right as that game is ending, that kind of stuff. So, you know, what can you do? So game five, Boston closed it out at home, 123-101. Boston had Russell had 25 points and 33 rebounds in that game. Series averages, Russell had 6 points per game, actually leading his team for once, which is unusual. Sharman had 20, Ramsey had 19. Meanwhile, Shays had 23.2 and Barnett had 19.4. So, not too much exciting about that series, but it happened. And other than the Arbeck in his underwear story, not a lot of and the dog on the court. Those are the two highlights of that series.
I'd say that's too many highlights. That's a lot of good highlights. I don't know what you're talking about.
There you go. So we'll continue somewhat with the Nationals in a few years with when we get to the 76ers mm-hmm. Franchise and Russell in starting in 65. But we've got a few rivalries to go in between that we need to cover before we get there. But definitely some interesting stuff.
Yeah, no, it's going to be a fun little series as well, because going through this and doing the research and looking at the names that we're going to mention and the people, it's just like amazing. I mean, of course, he played 13 years and they were obviously 13 huge years and impactful years, but just to see the amount of names that kind of come in and the amount of series and the amount of games that they had between the Celtics team, the idea of using Bill Russell as like sort of the center of all of it, it just works so perfectly. Because you see how much revolved around that guy during that period and how much revolved around him and those Celtics teams. So, yeah, this series is going to be really cool. And I think a lot of people are going to be interested just at how deep, each of these little episodes and each of these little micro episodes get with those different matchups and the different players and just the stories and stuff coming from all these different matchups. So, yeah, I think it's going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah, I think it's interesting to see how the teams evolve over, two or three years or, every other couple years, just right. The turnovers the team has. And we talked about it before, but I think the one thing that stood out with the Celtics is that they had so much stability and they had so much, they were able to, they knew what guys they wanted. They were able to keep it together and they didn't have the kind of turnover that almost every other franchise have. We're going to be talking about, in here, we're talking about playoff rivals. We're talking about the teams that were relatively successful, not to mention the teams that, like the Knicks and, at least until the late 60s and, and the Pistons up until then. And, the teams that didn't really make the playoffs during this time, we're not really going to talk about them. But, even the medium teams that weren't as good as the Celtics, but weren't as bad as the as we talked about, they still, by comparison, the Celtics were just such a amazing, stable organization, and everyone else is kind of in somewhat of chaos.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Because you look at, again, we're doing the key Celtics in that part and you see, and it's like almost the same thing. We can almost copy and paste the key Celtics every single year, but then the other teams, it's just radical movements in terms of, like we're talking about here, the Nationals, who in a few years will not even exist anymore. They'll be a complete, right. But yet the Celtics, there are a few guys here and there, for the most part is the same core each year. And so it's kind of funny to see everybody else sort of do whatever they can to compete and do this and survive. And honestly, yeah, in that era, NBA, survive in the city and make money and do all that sort of stuff and keep their players together and keep their franchises stable, and the Celtics just keep chugging along. So it's a fun sort of dichotomy between the Celtics and all these other teams we're going to talk about. So
yeah, all right, well, anything else, Rich?
I believe that's it.
Cool. Well, thanks everyone for checking it out. We appreciate it. You can find us at harvardparoxysm.com. You can find Over and Back NBA podcast on iTunes and or Stitcher. And we would appreciate ratings and reviews, positive ones, if you could. It would be nice. And you can find us on Twitter and Facebook at Over and Back NBA. So thanks for listening. And until next time, we'll be back again soon.